Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. As the 49th anniversary of Humanae Vitae approaches, there are signs on the horizon, not of celebration, but of danger. Marco Tozzatti, a respected journalist in Rome, recently wrote that in the Vatican, unconfirmed reports from good sources have leaked that the pontiff is on the verge of appointing, or even might have already formed, a secret commission to examine and potentially study changes to the Church's position on the issue of contraception, as it was laid down in 1968 by Blessed Paul VI in the encyclical Humanae Vitae. That was the last document signed by Pope Montini, and it was the formalization of what the Second Vatican Council has developed on this issue. Continuing, we have no official confirmation so far of the existence and composition of this entity, but a request for confirmation or for denial, which was put forward to the competent authorities, has so far not been answered, which could be a signal in itself, in the sense that if the report was completely unfounded, it wouldn't take much to say so. End quote, Mr. Tozzatti. He is unfortunately correct. One almost perceives an intentional uncertainty on the part of the Vatican under Pope Francis, simply and with finality, to confirm basic church teachings. And it's an old bureaucratic rule in the Vatican's bureaucracy as well as our own, that if you want to stay out of trouble, write a memo. If you want to cause trouble, name a committee. We know from the visionaries of Fatima that attacks on marriage and the family are the central ammunition in the war waged by the prince of this world in his battle to capture every living soul and condemn them to an eternity in hell. Now, PRI's longtime friend, chaplain, and board member, Father Linus Clovis, recently gave a penetrating summary of our current plight in an address he delivered in Rome. Following are a few of his most salient remarks. And I quote, 2 years prior to his election as Pope John Paul II, Karol Wojtyła, the Archbishop of Krakow, delivered a prophetic message in Philadelphia on the occasion of the bicentennial anniversary of American independence. We are now standing in the face of the greatest historical confrontation humanity has gone through. I do not think that wide circles of American society or wide circles of the Christian community realize this fully. We are now facing the final confrontation between the church and the anti-church of the gospel versus the anti-gospel, said Saint Pope John Paul when he was a cardinal. I continue. We must be prepared to undergo great trials in the not-too-distant future, trials that will require us to be ready to give up even our lives and a total gift of self to Christ and for Christ. Through your prayers and mine, it is possible to alleviate this tribulation, but it is no longer possible to avert it. How many times has the renewal of the church been brought about in blood? It will not be different this time. Continuing. Now, from Father Clovis. Cardinal Carlo Caffara, the founding president of the Pontifical John Paul II Institute for Studies on Marriage and the Family, wrote to Sister Lucia, the visionary of Fatima, asking for prayers for this new undertaking. She declared in a signed response to him that, and I quote, the final battle between the Lord and the kingdom of Satan will be about marriage and the family. Do not be afraid, she added, because anyone who works for the sanctity of marriage and the family will always be fought and opposed in every way because this is the decisive issue. And then she concluded, however, Our Lady has already crushed his head, end quote. The Cardinal noted that for John Paul II, this was the crux, as it touches the very pillar of creation, the truth of the relationship between man and woman and among generations. It is well known that any tampering with a keystone risks the collapse of the entire building. The keystone, the basic cell of society, is marriage and the family. With the tacit acceptance of contraception and divorce, the recent merciful embracing of remarried civil divorcees, and the benign nod to same-sex so-called marriage, the keystone has been tampered with and the omega point has been reached, thus far Cardinal Caffara. Now continuing with Father Linus. It is self-evident that the Catholic Church and the anti-church currently coexist in the same sacramental, liturgical, and juridical space. The latter, having grown stronger, is now attempting to pass itself off as the true church, all the better to induct or coerce the faithful into becoming adherents, promoters, and defenders of a secular ideology. Should the anti-church succeed in commandeering all the space of the true church, the rights of man will supplant the rights of God through the desecration of the sacraments, the sacrilege of the sanctuary, and the abuse of apostolic power. Thus, politicians who vote for abortion and same-sex marriage will be welcome at the communion rails. Husbands and wives who have abandoned their spouses and children and entered into adulterous relationships will be admitted to the sacraments. Priests and theologians who publicly reject Catholic doctrines and morals will be at liberty to exercise ministry and to spread dissent. While faithful Catholics will be marginalized, maligned, and discredited at every turn. Thus, the anti-church would succeed in achieving its goal of dethroning God as creator, savior, and sanctifier, and replacing him with the man, the self-creator, the self-savior, and the self-sanctifier. The advent of Pope Francis has, in the divine order of things, proved a great and true blessing. A hidden conflict has been raging in the Church for over 100 years, a conflict explicitly revealed to Pope Leo XIII, sustained by St. Pius X, and unleashed at Vatican II. Under Francis, the first Jesuit pope, the first pope from the Americas, and the first pope whose priestly ordination was in the New Rite, is now full-blown with the potential of rendering the Church smaller but more faithful. Consequently, there is a burgeoning fear among the more astute of the clergy, who, because of their training, education, and expertise in matters ecclesiastical, are generally able to see further and understand better than the average lay person the fallout from either an open conflict or the maintenance of the status quo. The apostolic exhortation Amatoris Laetitia is the catalyst that has divided not only bishops and episcopal conferences from each other, but priests from their bishops and from each other, and the laity, anxious and confused. As a Trojan horse, Amoris Laetitia spells spiritual ruin for the entire church. As a gauntlet thrown down, it calls for courage in overcoming fear. In either case, it is now poised to separate the anti-church of which St. John Paul II spoke from the church that Christ founded. As the separation begins to take place, each of us, like the angels, will have to decide for himself whether he would rather be wrong with Lucifer than right without him. Thus far the words of Father Clovis, and unsettling signs abound of the divisions which he describes. For instance, the bishops of Malta, a tiny island in the Mediterranean, have shown signs of outright opposition to the Church's basic teaching on two sacraments, that of marriage and that of the Holy Eucharist. It has not always been so. Malta is most well known as the site where, in 1565, after 4 months of heroic efforts against an overwhelming Muslim force, the valiant Catholic Knights of St. John of Jerusalem under Grand Master John Lavalette defeated the Saracen hordes of the Ottoman Empire who were intent on invading Europe from the south. It is worth noting that the Turkish Sultan Mustafa finally fled in defeat on September 11th, 1565. 6 years later, in 1571, the Turkish fleet was decisively annihilated at the Battle of Lepanto, in which the Order of St. John, now known as the Order of Malta, also played a central role. 112 years later, the last great Turkish threat to the heart of Europe was defeated on September 11th, 1683, with the victory of Polish King John Sobieski at the gates of Vienna. Who will our John La Valette be at our Lepanto? Who will be our John Sobieski at our Vienna? Once more, September 11th plays a critical role in the history of Christian-Islamic relations, decidedly unecumenical. When it comes to battle, Muslims have long memories. This is a beautiful history of Malta, and yet today Malta's bishops, the Catholic bishops, mind you, refuse to defend Catholic marriage. Instead, they condemn the Catholic faithful who do so, insisting that same-sex marriage is unnatural, because it is. It runs against natural law, as designed by God, because it does, and handed down to us through every generation in our Maltese history, because it has been. Instead of affirming these basic Catholic truths, Archbishop Charles Cicluna condemned them as propaganda. Moreover, in a recent statement, he and his colleagues in Malta issued guidelines that allow civilly divorced and remarried Catholics living in adultery to receive all the sacraments if they are at peace with God. Moreover, our own American bishops are focusing not on marriage and the family, but on money, specifically the hundreds of millions of dollars a year that our bishops and their welfare agencies receive from the federal government, from programs that are threatened by the budget submitted to Congress by President Trump. Pretending that the church, well, at least these bishops, has a magisterial position on budget allocations, five leading bishops from the Catholic Conference have written Congress condemning Trump's budget proposal and urging the full funding of all Obama's welfare programs, including, of course, those designated for the bishops' agencies. Meanwhile, the letter signed by five leaders of the Bishops' Conference made no mention of Trump's completely terminating all federal funding of Planned Parenthood. Hundreds of millions of dollars are at stake in taxpayer funding for the bishops, but there's no money in opposing abortion. So the bishops have made their priorities clear. The same is true when it comes to foreign policy, where Donald Trump has already done more to curtail funding for abortion abroad than any president in recent history, expanding the Mexico City policy to include all federal spending on all foreign aid. But what are the bishops' priorities? Not abortion. They focus instead on global warming, which is apparently the highest foreign policy priority of the American Catholic Church. They have even written to Secretary of State Tillerson a letter urging the United States to sign the Paris Agreement, committing billions to secular organizations supposedly fighting climate change. We are pleased to report that President Trump has recently returned from Europe, where he pointedly refused to sign the Paris Agreement. Did the bishops applaud Trump's expansion of Mexico City, keeping billions of taxpayer funding from abortionists worldwide? Well, not yet. We have a president who, without apology, stands for the sanctity of human life, Vice President Pence told graduates at Notre Dame. One wonders, do our bishops believe that fighting global warming is more important than fighting to save the unborn around the world? Meanwhile, with the 49th anniversary of Humanae Vitae quickly approaching, while the bishops' voices are stentorian in defense of Obama's funding of the welfare state, it is difficult to find a single voice applauding President Trump's pro-life accomplishments and commending his budget for zeroing out all funding of Planned Parenthood. Instead, Archbishop Joseph Kurtz of Louisville, the immediate past president of the Catholic Bishops' Conference and a prominent Catholic bishops' leader, criticizes the president's budget as, and I quote, at odds with American and Catholic ideals, never mentioning Planned Parenthood or the hundreds of millions of dollars the bishops' welfare agencies might lose if the budget is passed. And humane vitae, silence. Alas, it is furtive statements like these from our beloved bishops that lead good people to fear the worst should a commission be inaugurated to review this treasured encyclical of Blessed Paul VI. Will America's influential bishops urge Pope Francis to celebrate Humanae Vitae rather than to rewrite it? It's hard to say. After all, there are hundreds of millions of dollars at stake for the bishops and their welfare agencies, but there's no money for them in defending human life. This is PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood abortion liberales Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our Pro-Life Victory Seminars and our Pro-Life Strategy Guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything: strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them, the Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money, how to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today, the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now, we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you. Here's the latest weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. Jonathan Abamonte reports. Honduran lawmakers resist pressure from the United Nations abortion activists to legalize abortion. Last week, Honduran lawmakers resisted significant pressure from the United Nations, the European Union, and pro-abortion non-governmental organizations to legalize abortion. A proposal seeking to legalize abortion in cases of rape, fetal disability, and risks to life of the mother was initiated by foreign independent advisors from Spain, contracted by the Honduran government to help lawmakers revise the nation's penal code. The proposal came as the Honduran National Congress undertakes the first major comprehensive revision of the penal code since 1983. In response, thousands of pro-life Hondurans took to the streets of Tegucigalpa, the nation's capital, to protest the proposed change to the country's abortion law. Honduras faced brutal pressure from the international community to depenalize abortion, says Martha Lorena Alvarado of Provida Honduras. Pro-lifers, the young people, religious people, both Catholic and evangelical, responded immediately. The outpouring of support was tremendous, Alvarado says. We reacted as a pro-life country, and as a result, our nation's laws continue to defend the life of the unborn child from the moment of conception. End quote. Honduras is an overwhelmingly pro-life country. According to a recent Pew Research Center poll, 71% of Hondurans believe that abortion should be illegal in all circumstances. Currently, Honduran law protects all unborn life at any moment during pregnancy without exceptions. Lawmakers in the National Congress decisively rejected the abortion proposal. In the Legislative Assembly, 77 lawmakers voted in favor of Article 169 of the new penal code, which retains the nation's abortion law without loosening any of the restrictions currently in place. Five lawmakers voted against the measure while eight members abstained. Lawmakers further rebuffed efforts to legalize the morning-after pill. It was a complete defeat for them, according to Alvarado. Pro-abortion activists, however, had perceived the occasion as an opportunity to push for the legalization of abortion. In an attempt to win over public opinion, pro-abortion allies rushed to finance numerous television and radio advertisements that aired across the country in the days leading up to last week's vote. Pro-abortion NGOs, including UK-based Amnesty International and the US-based Center for Reproductive Rights, so-called, also weighed in the hopes of swaying lawmakers. By criminalizing abortion, the Honduran Penal Code is incompatible with human rights standards and must be modified without delay, said Erica Guevara Rosas, the America's director for Amnesty International, on the organization's website. A number of parliamentarians from Spain, Sweden, Finland, Slovenia, and Belgium in the EU's European Parliament also sent a letter to leaders in the Honduran National Congress last week, strongly urging lawmakers to legalize abortion to accord with purported international human rights standards. A group of United Nations so-called human rights experts also condemned Honduras for its laws in defense of life, charging that the Central American nation was failing to heed recent recommendations handed down by UN treaty bodies. And I quote, "We sincerely hope that the Honduran Congress will seize this key opportunity to comply with its obligations to eliminating discrimination against women in its legislation. We regret that the criminalization of abortion is maintained in the bill as a serious offense, despite recommendations from the UN's Universal Periodic Review and the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, as well as the Committee Against Torture." End quote. All of those committees, by the way, are funded in part by the U.S. taxpayer. For now. Honduras is a state party to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and to the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment and its optional protocol, is bound by the provisions of these UN treaties, to be sure. However, neither of these treaties mention abortion, let alone any purported human rights standard to legalize abortion. The UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women and the Committee Against Torture are charged with monitoring the implementation of these treaties, respectively. One concludes from its periodic review last fall that Honduras is to be condemned for its pro-life laws. It urges Honduras to come into compliance with circumstances under which abortion must be decriminalized, namely at least in cases of rape or incest, threat to the life and or health of the woman, and severe fetal impairment, end quote. However, recommendations issued by treaty bodies are non-binding on state parties. Despite claims that failing to legalize abortion is contrary to international human rights standards, no UN treaty compels any country to legalize abortion. On the contrary, the Plan of Action of the United Nations International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo in 1994, a landmark non-binding international agreement on population and development assistance, asserts that the decision of whether or not to legalize abortion should lie solely in the legislative processes in sovereign states. Furthermore, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights expresses the international consensus that all people have the right to life, liberty, and the security of person. It is reprehensible that UN human rights experts have turned human rights on its head, using the stature of their office to attack rather than to defend the universal right to life for the most defenseless among us, says Population Research Institute President Stephen Mosher. We need to continue to work to cut public funding from all entities, groups, and individuals who engage in this kind of cultural imperialism. End quote. That's our weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute. Thanks for listening. By now, we all know that Planned Parenthood is accused in the United States of allegedly violating the law by, among other atrocities, selling baby body parts. But what you might not realize is that Planned Parenthood's affiliates, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, and International Planned Parenthood Federation, IPPF, are still getting away with murder overseas. Around the world, and especially in Latin America, the baby-killing giant shades the truth about its abortion-related activities. It runs roughshod over local anti-abortion laws and violates local pro-life sentiment, all with seeming impunity. But not anymore. With your tax-deductible gift, PRI will throw the book at the abortion giants overseas, just as pro-life groups are doing here at home. Did you know that PPFA spends about $38 million a year lobbying to legalize abortion in countries around the world? If they're successful, they can kill as many, if not more, babies overseas as they do in the United States. But there's a hitch. Because abortion remains illegal in most Latin American countries, neither IPPF nor PPFA is eligible for government funding for abortion-related activities as they are in the United States. So PPFA, IPPF, gets around it as only they know how to do, by lying. With a wink and a nod, they disguise the programs they are funding as, quote, education or health programs, women's right, human rights protection or promotion, and anti-discrimination initiatives aimed at protecting vulnerable groups such as women or LGBTs, that means lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, end quote. Catholic bishops throughout Africa and Latin America complain about this. They call it ideological imperialism, but their voices are not heard in Congress because America's bishops depend on billions in government funding for their own charities. They don't want to bite the political hand that feeds them. Now, PRI receives no government funding, so we aren't hampered by golden handcuffs. That's why your tax-deductible gift to PRI is so important today. As the lead group investigating Planned Parenthood's activities overseas, PRI's Latin American office has uncovered PPFA's thinly disguised efforts to undermine pro-life laws and legitimate abortion on demand. But we've only found the tip of the iceberg, and there is more work to be done, work that we can't do alone. Your tax-deductible gift will help PRI hire a seasoned pro-life legal team to help us expose, investigate, and prosecute Planned Parenthood's affiliates everywhere they prey on women, especially overseas. Together, we'll expose, investigate, and prosecute PPFA and IPPF everywhere it tries to hide the truth. This two-prong attack, complementing the hearings taking place in Washington, will force Planned Parenthood to fight on two fronts. What better way to strike a blow against the real Planned Parenthood, the one we saw in all those horrific videos, than to come at them here and abroad? So please make a tax-deductible gift to support this and all of PRI's baby-saving efforts around the world. Yes, they're powerful. Yes, they're big. But remember, David and Goliath. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. When Vice President Pence spoke at Notre Dame, he said, and I quote, "Just as Notre Dame has stood strongly to protect its religious liberty, I'm proud that this president just took steps to ensure that the university and the Little Sisters of the Poor could not be forced to violate their consciences to fully participate in American civic life. And just as Notre Dame has stood for those who are persecuted for their faith around the world, Just a short while ago, in Saudi Arabia, the president, this president, spoke out against religious persecution of all people of all faiths. And on the world stage, he condemned, in his words, the murder of innocent Muslims, the oppression of women, the persecution of Jews, and the slaughter of Christians. End quote. Well, the vice president said a lot of things Obama didn't say 8 years ago at Notre Dame. How's this? And where this president stood for the unalienable right to life at home and abroad, I'm so proud that the University of Notre Dame has stood without apology for the sanctity of human life. Obama didn't say that either. The vice president continues. Far too many campuses across America have become characterized by speech codes, safe zones, tone policing, administration-sanctioned political correctness, all of which amounts to nothing less than the suppression of the freedom of speech. He continues, these all too common practices are destructive of learning and the pursuit of knowledge, and they are wholly outside the American tradition. As you, our youth, are the future, and universities the bellwether of thought and culture, I would submit that the increasing intolerance and suppression of the time-honored tradition of free expression on our campuses jeopardizes the liberties of every American. This should not and must not be met with silence. End quote. The vice president is correct. And yet the intolerance and suppression on college campuses continues. Students who don't know what a pronoun is are hectored if they use the wrong one when referring to one of their so-called transsexual classmates. The trannies' feelings are hurt, apparently, if you don't call yesterday's he a she today. Unfortunately, college students are taught to feel, not to think these days, and that's why Notre Dame students who were celebrated by the usual suspects in the left-wing media walked out on Vice President Pence because they insisted he made them feel unsafe. These are the Fighting Irish. Of course, had they felt really unsafe, they would never have gotten within a mile of his armed Secret Service detail. But these kids lost any sense of honesty and reality long ago, embracing the notion that they could be whatever sex they felt like being any hour of any given day, and everybody else ought to applaud them for it. Now, wait a minute. How about a little reality, please? When were they really unsafe? That was 21 years ago under President Bill Clinton, when one-third of the kids their age were aborted. That's when they were unsafe, not at Notre Dame 21 years later, with Vice President Mike Pence at the microphone. This frivolity continues. Students at Kellogg Community College in Battle Creek, Michigan, were actually arrested last month for distributing pocket-sized copies of the Constitution of the United States on the campus of the public college. And yes, unfortunately, the administrators and so-called leaders of the campus community are even crazier than the snowflakes. One administrator claimed that he was trying to protect what he called rural students who might be too polite to say no to those distributing the Constitution. The answer? Off with their heads. Arrest those who offend not the students, but the left-wing administrators. On the West Coast, a biology professor has had to move his class off campus because minority students insisted on having a no-whites day at Evergreen State College. Campus radicals have warned the college president, George Bridges, that if he did not accept their demands, there would be violence. This charade is going on all over the country. On the East Coast, international student Yang Shuping from China gave the student address at the University of Maryland's commencement. Yang told her fellow graduates that when she grew up in China, she had to wear a face mask whenever she went outside or she would get sick. She didn't mention that she was not permitted to have brothers or sisters. The longer she was in America, the more she said she appreciated free speech and democracy because in China, she complained, only state authorities within the Communist Party could define the truth. Well, those state authorities were not pleased. Yang was mercilessly attacked on social media in China, which is understandable since anyone commending her remarks would immediately be in trouble with those same authorities. And is there really free speech at Maryland? Well, the university's Office of Diversity and Inclusion, and I'm quoting here, guarantees all students a safe, inclusive, and welcoming campus environment for people of all sexual orientations and gender identities, end quote. What this means, of course, is that there is no freedom of speech at all for anyone who wants to defend normality, natural law, or Catholic teaching when it comes to the morality of homosexual acts and the idiocy of gender transformation. Yang wore a face mask in China. At U of M, she knew when to keep her mouth shut. Yes, students at the University of Maryland would undoubtedly be thrown off campus like the professor in the state of Washington for saying something so obvious. Here is one observation made by a former president in a letter to a friend of his in Pennsylvania, right next door to Maryland. The author is President John Adams, and his friend is Dr. Benjamin Rush. And I quote, "The Bible contains the most profound philosophy, the most perfect morality, and the most refined policy that was ever conceived upon the earth." Adams continues, "It is the most Republican book in the world, and I therefore will still revere it. The curses against fornication and adultery, and the prohibition of fornication or libidinous ogle of a woman, I believe to be the only system that did or ever will preserve a republic in the world." End quote. Thank you, Mr. President. Well, folks, on college campuses today, them are fighting words. This is PRI Review from pop.org. Thanks for listening.